Kiss Army. Welcome to Alive Unplugged, the Music of Kiss podcast series. Join us as we celebrate the hottest band in the world in song and conversation. Let's start the show with a couple of acoustic tunes from your host, Cameron Duty.
Hey folks, welcome once again to another installment of Alive Unplugged, the Music of Kiss podcast series, episode number 3, chatting today with a very special guest. As you have already discovered, of course, in the description on the episode, I'm really excited to let you all hear the chat that I had with Fraley's Comet and Cheap Trick alum Todd Howarth. which is just going to be fantastic. If you are familiar with a lot of his work, you will know that he has been in some of the 80s there, some very prolific bands, as we mentioned, Fraley's Comet. He did time with Cheap Trick. 707 was a big band that started off real hot before things kind of cooled down. So Todd has been around the music industry, and of course his more recent work, his solo stuff, and the great well-received 4x Fate album with John Regan and some of those other folks. But, you know, I had a chance to speak with him the other day, and we just had the best conversation, just talking about music in general, his music career, as well as his music inspirations and beyond. So I can't wait for you guys to hear the track. It's a great clip. It's going to be a little bit of a longer episode than what we usually do. But hey, that's what makes this fun, you know, getting to talk to people like this. And like I said, he was so gracious. Please check out all of his, you know, his material. Of course, you know, look him up online and on iTunes and all of the work that he's done. Great, great music there all the way across the board. I hope everyone's doing well. We're just coming off of this Easter weekend, for those of you who observe it. So, you know, we're getting into April. We've got a lot of exciting stuff coming up, both for Live Unplugged on the Facebook Live events, as well as in the KISS world. You know, we've got some releases to talk about. We've got some releases to come that we're pretty excited for, I know. And we'll get to all that as things go on. But right now, sit back, relax, and enjoy this program. I'm going to do a couple of acoustic tracks from our most recent Live Unplugged that was at the end of March. And then we're going to go right into this interview with Mr. Todd Howard. Take care. Thanks, as always, for listening. Be sure to check us out on all the links. We'll talk to you soon.
Trip while I was gone. You mind if I sit down for a while with you, babe? Reacquaint yourself with my style.
All right, Kiss Army and Alive Unplugged fans and friends, welcome back to another episode here. And I am honored to have a very cool guest with me today. This guy right here, you've listened to him your whole life. If you're a fan of Ace Frehley and Frehley's Comet, you know him. If you know him, you may know him from Cheap Trick. You may know him from 4x Fate, maybe 707. You guys know who I'm talking about, the great Mr. Todd Howarth. Thanks for coming on to Alive Unplugged, sir.
Well, Cameron, thank you very much for having me. It's great to meet you on screen here and talk about all stuff that I have accomplished and experienced in my past.
Yeah, it is a pleasure. Absolutely. You know, as I was telling you a little bit before we came on, with what I do, it's just such a fan of the music and of course, what it does for you know, a kid and a young adult growing up. You know, you have life experiences tied to all that. But even nowadays, 2021 with the COVID situation, it's been a great time to reflect and listen to a lot of music. And, you know, when I got to doing this podcast, I thought, you know, that I really thought now Todd Howarth would be a really great interview subject just because you've seen so much. And I think you've got such a unique perspective on a lot of what's happened in the last, you know, 70s and 80s in rock, not just particularly Yes, but, you know, other groups as well. So first off, I'll just go ahead and let you kind of just say hello and just let the fans kind of know what you got going on at the moment, because I know you're a busy man and then we may go back a few years.
That's fine. Yeah. Hello, everybody. Yeah, I'm again, my name's Todd Howarth. I've been around for 63 years. And, you know, I started my musical quest when I was about 7 years old. I was singing actually before I even heard the Beatles. And that's what started me into my musical career. Fast forward into today's events, after I learned how to play piano first, and I learned a little bit of guitar, then I was banging on the drums badly. And then bass and always singing and writing songs. I was told at a very young age, the first thing to do is the first and foremost thing you should learn how to do is write songs. So that's what I've been doing most of my life. I can play and I can rip a little bit here on whatever, but I'm not worried about leads. I'm worried about songs and melodies. So I played with the biggest bands I've played with, personally involved with, was, of course, my first big band was 707 from the early 80s, very early 80s. Then I ended up playing with Ted Nugent because we had toured with him, 707, and Ted had toured on many occasions. And then I ended up playing with Cheap Trick after Ted Nugent because I played with a lot of guys in L.A. who would eventually go to play with Cheap Trick, quite frankly, Pete Kamita and John Brandt. And then from Cheap Trick, I went on to play with Ace Frehley, Frehley's Comet, of course. And that was about a year and a half, I believe. And then I went through some personal tumult about a year and a half after that ended. And then I ended up playing back with Cheap Trick for about 6 years, all the while starting to do some more solo stuff. And then I ended up playing with a band called 4x Fate with John Regan, Rob Afuso, the final incarnation, Rob Afuso from Skid Row, Pat Gasparini from upstate New York, tremendous songwriter, guitar player, singer. And then John Regan and I had a band called Return of the Comet with Richie Scarlett and Steve Budgie Werner. And that's the last bands out of New York that I've been playing with until the pandemic hit. And all the while, all these years, I think I've done 5 solo CDs, and right now, currently, I know there's a lot of stuff going on here, but currently I'm recording 3 solo CDs. One's very heavy, one's more like easy listening again. I for lack of better terms, it's you know, it's not rock. And then the third one will be a bonus CD, acoustic songs of what I wrote and sang for in Frehley's Comet. And these are solo CDs because I am playing everything myself. I have I've had real drums. First CD I did, I used electronic keyboard drums. That was very stressful and horrible production-wise, but that's another story. But now I've got a set of electronic drums that are pretty damn good. I've got a pretty good sound out of them. I get the point across. You know, I'm pretty much Barney Rubble on the drums, you know, meat and potatoes, but I get the point across. Don't ask Rob Afuso, because we've got an electronic drum off coming pretty soon, where hopefully he's wearing pants. Anyhow, so that's what's going on there. And I'm doing my autobiography as well. So, yes, I'm balancing a lot of tennis balls in this juggling act I've got going on. Besides the fact that I'm taking care of my family's commercial real estate state down here in San Diego, California. So, yes, I'm a busy man. And by the way, here's just one set of keys that I have for properties and purple stuff. I have three of these. And, yes, I hate keys with a passion.
Absolutely. Listen, I don't blame you one bit. I wouldn't either. My key ring looks, you know, it don't even look a fourth of that. And I get aggravated with my mailbox keys and my work keys, car keys and the apartment keys. So I just can't imagine what you've got to go through.
But I know
you're busy. And like I said, one of the things that I've always appreciated about you is as we were talking about the songs that you did write, I'm a fan of songwriters all across the board. When you look at just from the Kiss point of view, Paul Stanley is my favorite songwriter with that band. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at bands such as, let's look outside of that, Journey. I love, Neil Sean, Jonathan Cain. You know, it just seems like I gravitate to those members, just for example.
Right.
And I like it because they have something to say. And then I can even look farther into other genres that I like, you know, country and different genres like that. I love a singer-songwriter. And that's one thing that I always liked about your material, especially with the Fraley's Comet stuff and then 4x Fate.
Thank you.
Yeah, man, you're welcome. But I've always enjoyed that because you could tell that a lot of what you wrote either A, come from experience, or B, you know, it came from inside, you know, creativity, mm-hmm. Creatively. So, you know what? You kind of answered my first question that I was going to kind of get to you about, but you're talking about...
Oh, I ruined it already.
No, you're good. It was a great segue. Let me tell you, that was great. You mentioned the Beatles. I'm going to assume that they're pretty early on your list of what inspired you to...
Oh, yeah. I mean, musically, my dad... He was into big band stuff. My mother and father were separated, divorced before I was even a year old. So I bounced around all over the place. And when my dad had me in visitation, he would play all this big band stuff in his cars. And, you know, I'd listen to it all and I didn't know what was going on. Just, okay, music, you know. And I was fascinated by all the instruments and how they would blend in and mesh and filter in the melodies and the bass lines and the construction. So I was already hooked on that. My mother was a singer and her father was a singer as well, not professionally, but they had a lot of talent. So when it came time for the Beatles to come on Ed Sullivan in 1964, I was living with my aunt and uncle and I had an older cousin who came from school. He said, they're going to be on. I'm like, who's going to be on, you know? And then the Beatles showed up on Ed Sullivan. And there they were, you know, cool with their long hair and their guitars. And the girls are screaming. And I've always liked girls and women. So that was a plus for me. Even at a young age going, yeah, I want to do that, you know. So then the music, of course, it hooked me. I mean, they had songs and melody and energy and such a cool look. And, yeah, that was the start of it, 1964.
What's your favorite Beatles tune, if you could narrow it down?
Oh, God, it would have to be anything off the first three. Melodically, actually, was Norwegian Wood was a great song. What a deep and dark song. Not dark, but deep song for me. Ticket to Ride was great. Taxman was fantastic. I mean, there's just so many. I just, you know, each one of them has an indelible mark for me. I mean, if I watched the movie Help, I'm like, oh, unbelievable. There's the one other song. What was it? I can't. Oh, yes, I remember. Old Age is Bitchin'. Hang on, I can't remember. anyhow, a lot of their songs just so inspiring for me because they had the pop rock element, and then they got heavier as they got, you know, just before the end of them. But that was a major first influence musically, was the Beatles.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. For me personally, I love the Please Please Me album, the entire thing.
Yes. Jesus,
I know it's not their most intricate, but, you know, they obviously had such a good pop sensibility. I love it. I even love some of the songs. Anna, you know, Go to Him, which wasn't even their own, but man, you know, they were a band. They recorded it.
You're bringing up memories. That's a great one. Also, You Got to Hide Your Love Away was, hey, you got to hide your love away. What a tune, you know. Yeah. So much soul. And then Helter Skelter, you know, later on, that rock energy. But yeah, you nailed it. You got some good influences as well.
Well, I appreciate that. Now, who else? Who else kind of molded you into the musician you wanted to be, Todd?
It was from the Beatles. You know, as I got into more into my, I mean, I did all the Beatles, Jackson 5. I listened to Jackson 5. I listened to, early stuff. The Osmonds even had some good stuff. I mean, that was early stuff, but I was always Beatles, you know. And then I got into, as I got older, heavier stuff like, you know, Humble Pie and Deep Purple, and Black Sabbath. At the same time I was listening to that, though, a lot of people don't realize I was listening to Joni Mitchell, Carole King, Phoebe Snow. I always get Phoebe Cates and kind of a visual difference there, but Phoebe Cates. I always listen to Phoebe Cates. So the songwriter aspect of it is very enticing to me. I mean, then I got Steely Dan, then I got into real progressive rock stuff because, you know, keyboards and guitars with the Kansas and Heart and Styx. But for Styx, only the heavy stuff. I was never into the overly hard stuff. That kind of drove me nuts.
Sure.
But then I got real heavy and dark. And then when Van Halen hit the stage, matter of fact, I saw them here. I'm not far from the San Jose Arena, and I saw them when they played here in 79.
Oh, wow.
And I had heard them on the radio, like, who the hell is it? And that's when the high voices were all the rage. And here comes David Lee Roth's, you know, throaty pitch. And I was like, all this great rock, heavy music, and this guy was deep. Who's a deep voice stuff? Or, you know, I mean, it sounded deep voice to me. And that was a big influence. Jeff Beck was huge for me in the guitar stuff. I mean, I don't play like him. The Babies, but, you know, that vibrato and that melody, that's what I really love to play. And so I would sit there and learn Jeff Beck. He had an album called Blow by Blow. It's all instrumental, and I learned as much as I could off that, you know, not anywhere as good as Jeff, but it was very influential for me. And then Jan Hammer, who played with them, it spanned out. There's so many different, Steely Dan was big for me for keyboards.
Yeah.
Zeppelin was always a staple.
Yeah.
You know, getting back to 14, 15 years old, I mean, I love Bonham, you know, just all that. And I love the mood of the music. You know, the whole band was phenomenal. I mean, so that's just in a nutshell. One of these days, I'm going to have to write this stuff down because people ask me questions. I draw blanks because there's so many influences, you know.
I think it's great because it kind of gives everybody a chance who may not have known this information to be introduced to, you know, what made you, you know, the singer, songwriter, guitar player, pianist, you know, that you are. I think that's fantastic. And I really like learning about people's roots. And you mentioned Steely Dan, who I love. They're not anyone that I could ever try to emulate on any instrument whatsoever. If you like to just sit and listen and, you know, put a good pair of headphones on, you know, something like Hey 19, which is my favorite, you don't realize how much was on in that recording until you really kind of immerse yourself in it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are all there's, I mean, I plus a Logic, Katie Lyde, all the early stuff. I was racing motocross as a teenager, you know, not professionally, you know, just for fun. And I would listen to my 8-tracks, Steely Dan in there, and then I'd have Styx or Kansas, you know, and then I'd have Black Sabbath and Humble Pie and just such a cacophony of different artists. But yeah, Steely Dan was phenomenal. I mean, I used to, it was learning the chords for those songs. I mean, you really have to learn the bass notes and then the inflections and the jazz fifths and minors and sevenths and major and minor. Just unbelievable. Same thing with, there's one song on the Jeff Beck Blow by Blow album that I learned on piano called Diamond Dust, which is just phenomenal song and the lead. And so I learned as much as I could on every instrument on that song. I still remember how to play that to this day.
Oh, that's awesome. You might want to record that.
I thought about it, but then, you know, yeah, you have to put your own spin on it. But, you know, I could do it. I'm also thinking about playing. I'm toying with the idea of re-recording some Cheap Trick songs just for fun, because I know they'd love that. They always bug me. Why don't you record some of our songs? I just might. So
you're also a master at segues, because I was getting ready to ask you, how did you, what got you into Cheap Trick? Were you a fan first?
And oh, then yeah.
Opportunity. Back,
it's funny. When I had my top 40 band, cover band here in San Diego in the late 70s, I first heard Cheap Trick. I thought, oh, I love this band. And their image, I thought their image was brilliant, because they had the two cool dudes and they had the two doofus looking dudes. Of course, you know, they were a phenomenal, intricate part of the band. I mean, they all were. Yeah. But I was hearing it going, oh, this stuff was great. And then they came out with the live album. And then shortly after that, I moved to L.A. And I was pounding the pavements, dragging around all my heavy keyboard equipment, my guitar stuff, and parts of a PA. That's, you know, and I'm a little guy. I'm only 5'7", so I'm not a big guy. So I'm lugging all this shit around myself. And I ended up playing with a guy named Mickey Free from a band called Valentino out of Chicago. And he and a bunch of other guys had moved from Chicago to set up in L.A. to make it, you know. And he went on to eventually to join Shalimar and some other stuff. But there's parts about in my book about him. But in his band, he had a few guys come through. One of them was actually a guy named Pete Kameda. I met actually Mickey Free through Pete Kameda, because Pete was playing with a band with Rudy Sarzo and Frank Benelli. They were trying to get something together, and they auditioned me as a keyboard player, and the late Frankie Benelli. And Frankie Benelli hated me, you know, because I wasn't a cool L.A. Oh, yeah, he didn't like me. I wasn't a cool L.A. cat, and I don't think I had all my chops up either, you know, that kind of thing. But Pete was a real nice guy. So he got me into this Mickey Free band. Well, Pete eventually left, and John Brandt started playing bass for them, or he knew the guys. And John Brandt, of course, was from the same area in Illinois. Consequently, further on down the line, the same guy was trying to produce and help them out. Pete Kameda ended up joining. He's a guitar player. He went joined Cheap Trick playing bass. And then they let him go and got John Brandt into the band playing bass. And when they were looking for keyboard players, they said, well, we know a guy out in California. He's young, but he's a parts player. You know, he can sing. He's got real good range and that kind of thing. So they auditioned me to be in the band. They actually wanted me when I was playing with Nugent, but I was playing with Nugent. And that's how I got in the band after two auditions, because the first audition, they really weren't that wild about me.
Yeah.
It's a funny story, but I mean, there's more to it. But that's how I got into the band, or got hired as a hired gun, you know.
Oh, yeah. But nevertheless, I mean, you're there and you're on the road and you're seeing the world and playing those songs that people are, you know, just loving night after night. Can't imagine what that was like for you. I know you enjoyed it.
It was fun. I played the biggest shows I've ever played was with 707, because we were on tour with REO Speedwagon in the High Infidelity tour. Smallest was 8,000 people. The biggest was, you know, Summerfest, and that was, I guess, upwards around 50,000 seat stadiums. So it was huge. So, you know, I mean, I played only smaller bands, and then my first big band, you know, we do a song for a movie, and all of a sudden we're doing the big tour. I think, all right, I've made it. Wrong. You know, it quickly died inside of a couple of years. And then I had a low spell, and then I ended up playing for Nugent, and we did, 6 months of a 1984 part in Europe and in part in the States, with pretty good venues, not as big as REO Speedwagons, but good venues. Yeah. And then that died, and then I, you know, Cheap Trick. And so I was used to the, And I never had stage fright. I did live broadcast right off the bat with 707. So I was, for me, it was fun. Yes, it was fun. A lot of experiences. It was also business.
Sure.
I mean, I at the time, you know, by the time I was in Cheap Trick, I had three small children, and I was going, man, I got to bust butt here and produce some results so I can pay for these kids, you know, and living.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I mean, I don't want to burst anybody's bubble. I mean, I worked very hard at it. I mean, for Cheap Trick, I never got to rehearse with the band. They said, okay, after, you know, I met from them the second time, the manager convinced them, look, the guy can sing. He's got 3-octave range. He can hit the notes and play everything. Said, okay, we'll give him a chance. So I learned all the parts in a garage at a horse ranch that my grandparents had, because at that time I had no place to live. Yeah. So I was learning all the parts, you know, playing and singing, and I did no guitar, just keyboards. And I, after 2 weeks rehearsal, they said, are you ready? I said, I'm ready. So they flew me out. I slipped in to a show after watching, or into a tour after watching, I think, two nights of their former keyboard player, who's a friend of mine, who is a phenomenal musician. They let him go and got me in there, and boom. And then they go to me, they said, why the hell didn't you sing like that at rehearsal? I said, well, because it wasn't a live stage, and, you know, there's more fun to sing live stage. So they're like, so, you know, that's, you know, I ended up staying for until a late 86 when I joined Fraley's Comet.
Wow. See, and you know, I'm really glad that you mentioned that. You know, there's something about a live audience that I think, you know, really as a performer would I've always would assume would bring out just, you know, adrenaline and really makes you go even that much more. One question that I've always had for people, and I've been around a lot of musicians, I've been lucky, and just a lot of talented people, and they always say, you know, studio recordings are great, but it's when you get on that stage is really probably when you do your best work, because you feed off of that energy. That is
very, very much so, because, you know, there's a front line. When there's a lot of people, you're looking out in the vast sea, if you're lucky enough for them to know your songs, and you're like, whoa, look at their, but then you focus on the front people as well. I mean, you call out to the people out there, but the front people, their faces are really, you really have a lot of fun connecting. Because as soon as they see you, seeing them having fun, and then I'm having fun because they're seeing me have fun. I mean, it's a fantastic thing. I mean, and I still, to this day, I get on stage, even if it's like, you know, small crowds, which we had with 4x Fate and Return of the Comet. It's still fun because at least the people that are there, they're having fun. And I love that. When I step on the stage, it's good times. And the switch goes on. It's not always a great performance. Matter of fact, half of the Return of the Comet shows I did, I was just coming off influenza laryngitis. I can only sing like 50-60%. Oh, wow. So it was horrible for me. But, you know, I still gave it my all as best I could. And recording, like I mentioned, like I'm recording right now and I'm doing everything myself, it is boring, but there are good parts when you get the take you want or the feel you want. And, that's the most satisfying. But, you know, I sit in there and I'm in there 4 or 5 hours by myself doing everything. And that's about it. My ears can't take anymore because it's like, you know, they're beat to hell. So I've got to give them a break. And to be on stage, yeah, it is the best.
Yeah, I can tell you that from my experience, like I said, very amateur. I've been lucky. I've done a lot of these Facebook Live events. If anybody's listening to Live Unplugged, I'm sure a lot of them's learned about what I do for fun in my spare time. But, you know, I play a lot in our local town events too, town fairs and county fairs and, you know, festivals, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I can just tell you the fun part about that for me, and I don't do it on a professional level, but is when you play something that somebody enjoys. And, you know, that may be to a crowd of 100, 200 or less. But, you know, coming from that, hearing what you're saying, you know, even I can relate to that, because when you are enjoying something and somebody else is enjoying what you're doing, you can't beat that, whether there's 10 or 10,000.
Exactly.
But you started to mention Fraley's Comet. And, of course, you know, we're here on this KISS-related podcast. So, you know, that's bound to come up.
As it should.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I've always been floored with those recordings. I've loved them ever since I discovered them. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But sure. Go ahead and tell me about how you got connected with those guys. If I'm not mistaken, it's through John Reagan, right?
Yes. Yeah. I was on a tour again with Cheap Trick, and I think it was earlier 86. And he was playing with John Waite from I Ain't Missing You At All, you know, that tour.
Yeah.
And which wasn't the name of the tour, but I just like that song. We would do, double headliner. I mean, alternating headliners shows. And I was always a big Babies fan. So, you know, it was like a big treat for me to see John Waite. And so I would listen to their sound checks, and usually John Waite wasn't there. Big surprise. But the band was there. Frankie LaRock on drums. Arthur Stead on keyboards, who was, you know, doing the early Fraley's Comet stuff. And then John Regan, of who I didn't know at the time either, and another guitar player, phenomenal guy. And I would listen to the recording. See, I like big, heavy beats, and I like solid bottom end. And between John Regan and Frankie LaRocca, it was like, holy moly, what a backbeat. You know, John's just in the pocket. And so after a couple times of watching this, I said, I just walked to him, you know, and when he got off stage, sound check, and I introduced myself. Said, "Hey, I'm Todd Howarth, and you know, I play keyboards for Cheap Trick." "Yeah, I know. I've been seeing you singing up there, your butt off." I said, "Thank you." He said, "Yeah, I'm John Regan. I'm so and so." And I would come to learn later on of John's resume. You know, I didn't know he was working with Ace Frehley at the time, but you know, Peter Frampton and all the huge, you know, I was a big Frampton fan when I was young too. That's another person I used to listen to. So we got to talk, and I told him, you know, I'm not only a keyboard player, I play guitar, I'm a lead singer, and I write songs, you know, because you always network and branch out, especially when you're trying to make new contacts. And he said, "Well, that's interesting." He says, "I'm working on a project that I can't tell you about right now, but let's exchange, you know, info," and you know, and I said, "Okay, let's do that." So he did, and about, I think it was the latter part of 86, which would have been 4 or 5 months later, he had given me a call and said, "Look, this is kind of coming together, and we'd like you to come audition." And about that time, I'd had enough of certain characters or characteristics of the band Cheap Trick. I mean, I love the band. It's one of my favorite bands, American bands, period. But, you know, it's like a marriage, especially when you're a hired gun. Sometimes things just get on your nerves, and you go, "Okay, I'm done." Yeah. So I thought, okay, I'm going to stop playing for Cheap Trick and go with Fraley's Comet. And I had to audition for Fraley's Comet twice. Oh. Because I flew out there, and, you know, Ace was like, "Hey, it's okay, you know." And no, trust me, John's going, "Trust me, this is the guy you want, because, you know, songwriting, singing, you know, blah, blah, blah." And so the second time around, I would fly out and audition on the way to a leg of a Cheap Trick tour. And so the second time, you know, Ace goes, "Okay, I guess it'll work," you know. So, and that's how I got into Fraley's Comet.
Yeah. Good impression, by the way.
I spent a little time with him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you did. What was he like to be around? I know that he is his own kind. I mean, you're not the spaceman for nothing.
Right. Yeah. At that point in time, he was probably one of the most straightforward, driven, hardworking guy, musician, to have to start over as such, because he had high hopes for this label, a Megaforce label, and distributed through Atlantic. So he was focused on what he wanted to do. And he had all the parts and combinations together to make it happen. And he put it forth, and he was a pleasure to work with. It was fun. I learned stuff. And I'm forever grateful for him going, "Hey, play this," you know. And it was his Black Steinberger, GN1 Steinberger.
Oh, wow.
Trans-tremolo. I said, "What the hell is this?" And, well, the neck's kind of skinny, because I like Les Paul necks. You know, I learned on a 1957 Les Paul TV model by Gibson. But the sound I would get out of that thing through my 100-watt Marshalls, like, holy crap, this thing is phenomenal. So then I ordered my red one. But getting back to Ace, he was very, I mean, he was the man. He was you know, the guy from Kiss. It was his band. He was very generous. And for the all three albums that I did, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to contribute what I did songwriting. And then, you know, some of my leads, especially on It's Over Now, he let me do all that. And he never said, no, I need to do it. I want to do it. And because had he at that point in time, I said, okay, you're the boss. You know, it's your band. And I was very, very fortunate to have been a part of that process and that band at that time. And I mean, he had his ups and downs as we ended, you know, the Comet winded down in, what the hell was it, 88, you know, mid-88, and we had problems. And I mean, I don't need to get into that stuff, I guess, unless you ask, but there were some things, that old habits he got back into, but it was nothing really astronomically bad or anything. You know, it's just Ace, you know, going, ah, crap. You know, exactly. But he was putting a lot of effort into it. And I think he expected faster and quicker results, and it wasn't happening as quickly as he wanted it to. But what we didn't realize, and here comes this new kind of music is coming up right behind us.
Oh yeah,
and it was cleaning house.
Oh yeah, I mean, you're exactly right about that. You know, that point that we're talking about, obviously, kind of, you talk about even Guns N' Roses changed things, even though they were still in that same vein of you guys. They changed the style, the kind of the climate. Oh. And then you talk about Nirvana and the grunge albums that come from that. And it's really interesting. I think that I noticed something when you were talking, and I could be wrong. It's just my point of view. You talked about the rise the incline, you know, trying to get Fraley's Comet to the plateau or to the top, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was probably used to a lot of the results that came from his first band.
There you go.
I mean, that's the way I see it, you know. In 73, you know, you play a couple gigs in New York and get hooked up with a bill of coin, and then you're on your way.
Mm-hmm.
Not always the case, I can imagine. But
no, it had to be very frustrating for him. See, I was used to, you know, busting ass, and learning the songs, doing the shows, pulling my weight, and then some, you know, weight of others at times. And then going from there to being virtually broke, having to collect unemployment, or, you know, doing physical work, which I'm not afraid of. I've always done physical work. I'm doing physical work to this day to support my furthering of, you know, what I'd like to do musically, because it's still expensive. But I learned that, hey, you know, you're going to have crap times and you're going to have good times. And exactly, Ace did not know that, or didn't, because he had great success with Kiss. He could bow out, still made money, and then he could, you know, it probably was a huge disappointment for him for it not to go bang, bang, bang. Yeah, and Guns N' Roses had opened up for Cheap Trick in Long Beach when we played with Cheap Trick in 86. And I'm like, who the hell are these guys? And they're just smoking band, you know? And yeah, that was coming up right up our butts, and we didn't even know it, you know? You can't battle trends that are coming at you. And that's also another thing that took place, you know, the different type of bands coming out.
Oh, sure. And we'll talk real quick about that original Fraley's Comet album, which is still a classic. I mean, you can't listen to Hair Nation on Sirius XM or, you know, go to, I know it's now defunct, but when VH1 Classic was a big name, you know, Into the Night, which is one of my favorite, not just Fraley's Comet songs, but rock songs. When it
cool.
was all the time, you know, I mean, it was all over the place, and it songs like that stick out. And so it has to feel good to have been associated with something that, you know, how many years are we removed from it? 34, I guess.
Just at this point, yeah, 87 would be about 34, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's still so well renowned to the fact that you're able to do a project such as Return of the Comet that features so many of those songs. What do you remember about that recording process, and how does that album stand out to you when you look back on it today?
When I look back on it now, I have far more respect and admiration for it, because I did not realize the indelible memories it would put into the many millions of ears that it got into, yours included. And I'm saying that only as a realistic point of view, as opposed to a calloused or, a narcissistic point of view from when I first started doing it. When I came into the band, a lot of tracks were already recorded, and I embellished or added to, which is the same thing, and then added my stuff. So there are some keyboard stuff on there that I did not play on the first album that I would not have played. That song In Tonight was one of them. I wouldn't have done certain things certain way, but that doesn't matter. The point is that when I was listening to these songs, I think, well, okay, these are okay tunes. They weren't as heavy as I wanted to be. And people always think of me as not being heavy because I write heavy songs and then I sing, they're no longer heavy because I'm singing them. I don't have a heavy voice. I can be, you know, a rock type singer, but it doesn't really have that heavy appearance, I guess, to a lot of people in audio sense. But getting back to the songs, there are songs that we had that I like some more than others. There were songs in there that I couldn't understand why they were on the record. So, you know, it's like, why are we, or why is this song being put on the record? You know, it's a hard time for me to consider it being my record, because, you know, it was Ace's record. It would come to be our records. But so I had a different perspective then to go, like, why is this song on this record? Oh, because it's not my record. If it was my record, I'd say, let's shelve this and do something else ballsier. You know, I always wanted to go heavier. But over the years, I gained more respect and admiration for the very tunes that we did with Return of the Comet. You know, Richie and I sat and talked about a lot of stuff when I flew out to hang with him for 3 days, get to know him, you know, and talk about songs we wanted to do. And it's amazing the parallels we have in musical tastes and what we want to do, what we don't want to do. Even though he's like complete, you know, 180 from me, we still have the same viewpoints of music that stem from Kiss and the involvement of Kiss or the lack thereof. So we had fun playing these tunes because they were of yesterdecades, and we had a whole new, or at least I did, a whole new level of respect for them because the fans enjoyed it, and they still want to hear it. Then that means it's important even more so.
Yeah.
So that's how I've looked at it for, you know, three plus decades.
Absolutely. Can I take one guess at what maybe one of the songs were that you kind of wondered why it was being put on that?
Yes, you can.
Is it Dolls?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
You know, it's you know, and that's it's you know, taste is subjective, of course. And the thing is, when Ace told me, when I said this song, and I asked him flat out, what is this song about? What inspired it? And he told me what it was inspired him to write it. You know, when he was telling Monique, I believe this is what he told me. If to be true, I don't know. I'm assuming it's true. But he used to tell stories to his bedtime stories to his daughter Monique, and she had all these balls lined up on the walls or the shelves or whatever. And so he just came up with this idea to sing about dolls. Now I get that. I really do, because because I have kids too. But see, the way I would have done it is like, okay, this song's called Dolls, but it's going to be a lot darker. And because those dolls come to life at night and try to kill you. That's my imagination. That's how I write shit. You know?
Yeah, something you'd find on Nightmare on Elm Street, right? Something you'd find on Nightmare on Elm Street soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, that's much better, more fun for me. So, again, you know, songwriting and your influences or tastes are subjective, and that's how it goes. I mean, I wasn't my record. I would have done things differently. And then, of course, there's a lot of listeners that would have, you know, done things differently, you know, not having some of my songs on there and have more Ace songs. So I get that, you know.
Yeah.
For me, what I was going to do next third studio album for Fraley's Comet was really sit down with Ace, because at that point, I really knew what he was about and what we could get across. I tried to get a couple songs in there for Second Sighting that kind of like had a collaboration type thing. It was kind of a hit and miss there. But I thought, okay, for the third record, we're going to sit down and really collaborate, and I'll lay out a foundation for Ace, and he can do his interjections, and it'll be, you know, something a lot of fun. That was never to be. So unfortunately, that didn't happen.
I would love to have heard that. I think that would have been great. That would have been really, really nice.
Thank you. I think it would have been a lot of fun for a lot of listeners.
You know, you're talking about Second Sighting. That has a special place to me because as I was just a young kid, I'm 31 now. When I was about 14 or 15, I guess, I discovered the Second Sighting album.
Wow.
Well, you remember FYEs? I guess they're still around. We don't have one here anymore, but the FYE Entertainment Store.
Wow. You
know, I found one of those copies of Second Sighting. And obviously, being a Ace Frehley fan, I knew, well, I got to get this. And that was where I was introduced to your music. And you made the comment about, you know, certain fans want, you know, more Ace than what they got. To me, I was a fan of Kiss. I knew Paul Stanley didn't sing every song. I knew Gene didn't sing every song. Mm-hmm. I knew Ace certainly didn't sing every song. So it never crossed my mind. I love the dynamic that you would have Ace one track and then we would have one from you. And I will go ahead and tell you that a couple of my favorites are It's Over Now, Time Ain't Running Out, and New Kind of Lover is actually my favorite song on the entire album.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I know that you mentioned having, you know, more input on those. Was that something that you said that he was really laid back when it comes to recording, and if you had an idea, he let you put that idea in it? Was that methodical though? Was that something that the record label wanted to be like, you know, we want some Todd tracks, but you know, we want some Ace rockers too, or was it just, you know, let's just throw something at the wall and see if it sticks?
No, it wasn't like that at all. First off, thank you. I'm very flattered that you enjoyed those tunes. I mean, New Kind of Lover was a song that was written for another movie proposal that never came to pass. I think it was a movie that had David Duchovny in it. But I wrote that for that idea. No, what happened for Second Sighting is we went into the studio pretty quickly to do that. It was kind of a strategic move financially and also for the new release of the new record time frame to get it out there. There's been speculation about it. Maybe it's too fast to do that. Could have let the first record play out a little bit longer, but nonetheless, history is what it was. As far as the songwriting goes, Ace has a different style of songwriting, obviously, than I do. And he did not have a lot of songs prepared, if at all, for the Second Sighting. Mm-hmm. Then he ended up having a lot of, he had a chest infection through a lot of recording of that. So he ended up being home a lot. And we were in the recording. And so we had to put songs forth. And John says, have you got songs? I said, yeah, I've got plenty of songs. You know, so that's why I ended up principally writing, you know, half that record. A lot of people thought, oh, Todd's trying to take over the comment. Well, that wasn't the case. I just had songs ready. Sure. As a matter of fact, I wrote Loser in a Fight, you know, I wrote that completely, but I give credit to it, to the guys and especially John, because, you know, he was very well deserving. And I wanted Ace to be a part of that. And I really didn't, I knew it would be disaster if I ended up singing too many songs, because I'm not, you know, I wasn't Ace, and people need to hear Ace. Ace is not a singer, but people need to hear his vocals because that's his character. And they are Kiss fans, they are Ace fans. And luckily, I got a lot of fans from that, but you had to pay attention to the Kiss fans and the Ace fans first, because they were paramount. That was extremely important. So I thought, this is dangerous waters, but we had little choice, actually. I mean, we had choice, but we didn't because of the time frame. So I ended up having the songs and put them out there. And there's a lot of things I did on the record that nobody knows that I did to help the guitar playing out that maybe didn't pan out for certain parts. And a lot of people don't know this. On It's Over Now, that's just Anton, me, and John Regan. Nobody else.
Really?
And I'm doing all the guitars, all the keyboards, all the singing. And not Anton, Jamie Aldaker. Sorry. Jamie Aldaker playing, the late, great Jamie Aldaker, mm-hmm. Playing the drums. And John Regan, of course, on bass. And it would have been neat to have Ace's input in it. You know, it was a band and was almost a complete band. I think by that third record, we would have been a complete band. You know, I did want to take some more leads here and there on certain songs. But I wasn't, you know, I wasn't the flash lead player. I can be it. I can do it. It's all melody to me. But yeah, it was just so close. And then with the, you know, the breath on our backs from grunge and the likes of, you know, Guns N' Roses, you know, and great band, and a lot of those bands I really like. I mean, into the 90s, you know, I had to reevaluate and relearn new stuff and become invigorated, inspired. And I know a lot of Kiss fans don't like those bands, and I get that, but I liked them because I learned even more stuff. I'm always learning. I mean, I listened to stuff, and I learned stuff from Alice in Chains, Stone Temple Pilots, Korn, Chevelle, Saliva. I mean, there's so many bands that have so much good stuff out there. But yeah, I'm getting way ahead of the questions here.
No, fine. You're fine. I'm just enjoying the stories and your point of view. I think that's great. So, you know, I know, you know, and again about that album, The Second Sighting, yeah, it'll always be a special one to me. And something, yeah, you're welcome. And something that I think is really cool. I jammed to it again today as I was getting ready and coming home. Oh, yeah. And preparing for everything, and just wanted to again refresh myself on something I knew very familiar, you know, to me, but I still wanted to just kind of listen to it again, you know, after maybe a few, you know, months or so without really listening to it. And because you know how you do, you go through seasons and you'll listen to an album and then you'll put it away and then you'll come back to it,
right?
And when we got this opportunity, you know, I really went back and looked at a lot of the Fraley's Comet stuff, including the live EP and, of course, the Greatest Hits live album that come out about 10 or 15 years ago. And, I mean, you guys were a hot act. I mean, when it come to playing live, too, I mean, you guys really had the stuff down.
Thank you for doing your homework. That's nice to hear. I mean, it means you're serious behind the questions, if nothing more than that, and being a fan. I mean, I'm not saying other people have you know, haven't done good interviews, but it's nice to see somebody digging deep and getting into it. And getting to the live aspect of what you talked about, we had fun being on stage. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were there to play and to perform music, but we didn't take ourselves overly too seriously. We want to do a good performance, you know, but we were going to break down in tears when something went wrong, and things always go wrong live. But we had fun. Ace and John and I, we had a blast. And then we had Billy Ward, the first live Comet drummer, and then Jamie Altaker. We all had fun, because when you have fun on stage and you're kicking ass, the audience knows that. They have fun. Then they have fun watching you have fun, watching them have fun. And it's just reciprocal. It's just amazing, you know.
Yeah. Definitely. And I think it comes across on any recordings that you see. I mean, you can look on YouTube as well, and there's always somebody who's recorded a gig or found a soundboard recording or something, and they're always fun to listen to. And, you know, I know you'd mentioned like Into the Night, which I've told you I've always been a fan of, but you guys added a different energy to it.
Mm-hmm.
With the versions that I've heard, as opposed to what happened in the studio. And I see that now. You know, you're talking about some of that was already done by the time you got there. You could really hear you all interject your parts into those live recordings.
Thank you. And that was the thing where they, you know, Cheap Trick used to do the thing when they'd go in the studio to do pre-production. They'd get me in there especially when I was on tour with them. And they'd sit me, what do you think? You know, put something in there, and I'd add stuff, and you know, they'd, you know, either yay or nay, or they wouldn't say anything at all, and then use it later on, which a couple times they did. No big deal. Not much. I mean, that I contributed that much to their talent. But for Ace and John and Eddie Kramer, and then we produced Scott Mabuchi, the second album, you know, when they first put me in there and said, what do you hear? I said, well, I hear this harmony or I hear that. And I had to be careful not to make it too pretty or, you know, too much of a spread. But I stuck some high harmonies in there or some, you know, dissonant fifths and thirds and some different keyboard stuff or string orchestration. Because I'm a big fan of simple string orchestration, which I learned a lot of that. In Cheap Trick Band, you know, playing, I mean, on my keyboard, I had programs sometimes that have six different sounds going at the same time, like Dream Police, you know, or oh, yeah. Heaven Tonight or that kind of stuff. But I would interject my ideas and they go, that sounds great. Or they go, well, try this or try that. So the freedom was there. And then when you go live, you know, it's like, well, this is the part that I really put in here. And, you know, regardless of, you know, I didn't write, Russ Ballard wrote Into the Night, but I had fun playing and singing it, you know, and as with some of the other songs that were on the first album. So I made them ours. And I got a lot of fans out of that, you know. You know, a rough couple of years because a lot of people didn't like me because, you know, I wasn't Richie Scarlett or I wasn't part of the Kiss mode. I was a blonde-haired guy that had, from California, no less, that had no business being around Ace Frehley. Like, okay, yeah, but I like Van Halen, so, you know, what are you doing?
Well, I can tell you,
well, I really
did. Yeah, I did. I loved it from the beginning. I had no preconceived notion. Like I said, just growing up in the time frame I did, late 90s, early 2000s, you know, being born in 89, I just discovered it all. You know, when I came across it, I came across it. And to me, I think it's been a great perception because I can go back and look at it. And was I there in the moment? No. But in a way, I really think that that helps kind of open my eyes and ears to not being one-sided to a certain. You know,
it is. Oh, yes, I do, because it's not only flattering to hear, but it's an indelible memory for you to hear, live, envision, audio fantasize about what was it like, you know, that 15, because I'll be 64 this year. You know, I'm twice your age. So it's I'm living vicariously through your enthusiasm for this music that I made, you know, years ago. So it's an honor to hear that. I mean, and I do the same thing with a lot of my old stuff. Even when I listen to Beatles or it's from when I was 15 years old. And now, as well as when I put it on, I listen to it, go, whoa, that was so great. You know, and that one little feedback and the Tommy Bolin's getting tighter. I don't know if you remember a guy named Tommy Bolin played with Deep Purple for a while. And then he did his own thing. And he had this one song called Getting Tighter. And he would. And every time I play the record, there's one little feedback in that one part of the song. Oh, man, you know, it's just you live for those type of indelible memories. And that's something that, you know, you can't take away from the fans that live that and want to hear it again and are still there today. I mean, God bless them. Thank you. I mean, if it wasn't for them, from all the bands I play with, the Kiss fans are the best. I'll tell you that flat out. It's something I never knew. I had to learn that. But if it wasn't for all these fans, there's no reason I'd be doing this right now. Because I don't, you know, I'm not in it to make money. I don't make a real living at it anymore. It's back to a hobby now because I could be retired, easily retired right now. But I'm doing it because people still want to listen. You're one of them. Yeah. So it's a shit that keeps me going every time I go into my studio. And I'm dead tired after doing physical stuff because I'm very physical even to this day at my age. And I've got to put 4 or 5 more hours until 9 o'clock at night, which is a long night for me after doing physical stuff in the morning. I mean, all day. And then I go, I'm doing this because people still want to hear it. It may be the last things I'm doing because I'd like to be able to hear by the time I'm 80. But thank God for the fans and your memories.
Yeah. Yeah. And thank you for making them for us. I can certainly say that, Todd. I also, you know, and now we'll fast forward, and of course you can talk about your solo stuff just as much as you want to, and
sure.
you can say anything because those are some great recordings as well. We will touch real quick, and you know we'll talk about 2000 ish, you know, Cold Beach.
Oh yeah,
great tune that I always
thank
enjoy.
You.
Yeah, so I've always followed your stuff even outside of the Kiss related stuff. 4x Fate, which I thought was a fantastic album. These Times Are Hard for Lovers. I mean, I thought that was one of the coolest openers that I'd heard.
Really? Cool.
Yeah.
I told John I didn't want to do. I said, yeah, let's not. I love John Waite. You know, that was his song. And I told John Reyes, yeah, this doesn't really sound heavy enough for us to do. I mean, I love John Waite. I'd rather do a baby's tune. But he wanted to do that song, and he insisted on it. So, okay. And it turned out that a lot of people liked it. That's fantastic.
It did. And that bass, the groove that he has, that John has on that bass part. Oh, man.
Solid. Nobody better.
Yeah. Moonshine is also one of my favorites.
Pat Gasparini, that too. What a tune.
Yes. And I love the version of It's Over Now, being a Fairleigh's Comet fan. I love seeing that on there. And then, you know, I like the version of Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. That was really cool. I think the whole album itself is fantastic. And your patriotism also shows at the end of it as well. Thank you. And, you know, that's an album that I'd like to recommend to anyone that I know was a thrill to you guys to get to record. And it's still on my, you know, constant rotation on my Apple Music or on my CD player. And then from there, you go to that Return of the Comet. What are the odds, Todd, that when this pandemic lifts and we get back to normal, we can see either a Four by Fate or Return of the Comet come to, you know, some theaters and do some shows in 2022 or just whenever? I mean, can we see that, maybe a return when this ends? I think the one's there, you know?
That is highly plausible. I can never say never. I mean, I don't think anybody in the band would say never about anything. You know, a few members may change based on availability or desire. I don't know. It's so hard to forecast that type of stuff because, you know, as the year, then this year will go by, you know, then next year, because we haven't played anything. We had stuff set up for 2020, but that got, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
So it'll be a couple of years before doing anything, or maybe almost 3 years. It's definitely possible. And along with, you know, I mean, even if Ace, you know, and we've always said this, John Regan and I have said this, if Ace, you know, decided, hey, let's do a Fairleigh's Comet thing, you know, reunion, which I thought would be very smart for him to do, you know, we'd be up for that as well. Who knows what's going to happen? It's a possibility. It really is. I think it's important for me at this point to get my book done, my autobiography, which is about 7/8 done, and then these three solo things out. So I'm desperately working on this right now to get this stuff done so I can have it out of the way in case something comes up for the next year, because I don't think I'll be done until the end of this year with these three albums. The touring thing, you know, this whole political global climate thing of what's truth and what's not truth may get in the way for some performances, live performances, and preferences of vaccinations or the lack thereof. So that's a dynamic that's going to have to be played out. And what a mess. It's a mess. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's robbing a lot of people out of live music. I went to Sturgis just this last year. Last year? What the hell? Yeah, I guess last year. And we got to see some live bands play. I didn't play, but it was fun to see bands up there playing, and they were thrilled to be playing, you know, because that's just the way it was. So, yeah, I would definitely like to get back out there. For how much longer, I don't know. Like I said, my ears can only take so much, and I like to be able to hear, you know, this left ear is ringing like crazy right now.
Oh, sure, man. Have you ever considered doing the jumping on board with the Facebook Live things, you know, maybe doing a Facebook Live one day?
Yes, I have. And the thing for that is it's like when I get ready for a tour or for shows like we did 2 weeks in Australia, I had to, you know, bust my ass, get my voice in shape. I mean, my voice is in pretty good shape, but, you know, I'm not 20 anymore. So I have to usually spend about I like to spend about 5 days to a week getting my voice into the range and strength that it can for the shows. Cause during that tour, I had to sing virtually every night for over 2 weeks. Mm. So, because I'm spending all my time on recording, when to do like a live broadcast, I want to spend all my time getting, you know, cause there's people think I sit around and play, you know, New Kind of Lover and whatever all the time. Some of that songs I have to go, I have no idea what I played. I'll have to remember how to play. You know, I mean, I remember how to play, but you know, the arrangements and stuff like that. And, New Kind of Lover, you know, I never sang it and played it live because we never did it live. No. So I have to get ready to do that kind of stuff. So that would take some preparation. But yes, I have thought, to answer your question in a broad circle 8 method there, yes, I have thought about doing that. And I think it'd be very fun, much fun.
I agree 100%. And when you decide to do that, I'll be sharing it and supporting the heck out of it. That's for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome, man. Hey, listen, I know it's been about an hour, and I just greatly appreciate all of your time. I know you're a busy man, and you got a lot going on, but I've really appreciated this. You are my first musical guest on my show, so that means a whole lot.
I'm honored. Yay, I'm number one. No, thank you very much. I appreciate that. You did, like I said, you did your homework. You mentioned Cold Beach, which is a single video that I did. Thank God to a fan, a guy named Brian Sword out of Canada, wanted to film me doing something. And I mean, if you got a second, I'll tell you about this, that tune. He wanted to film me doing a new song. This is a few years back. And I said, well, yeah, but I really don't have any right now. I said, well, I'd like to do something. He said, well, what do you want to hear about? You know, what would you like? Well, something about your off-road stuff that you like, you know? And I said, I will write one. So I wrote Cold Beach because he wanted to use my dune buggy, my sand rail at the time for that. So I quickly wrote a song. And I got my old drummer, who's here local, a guy named Bob Sale, who's phenomenal, to do the drums. And then for the fast lead, I want somebody ripping leads. So I got another friend of mine who played in my band Hardware here in California, Jeffrey Marshall, to do the fast lead guitar part on that. And they're both credited for that. And then I did everything else, of course. And we filmed it out in the desert with my good buddy, Bob Robert Norris, Big Bob, out there helping out. And it was just us three. We filmed it, did it. And Brian Sword did an amazing job on it. And it'll probably be a bonus track on one of the CDs.
Great. I really enjoyed it. I certainly.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Todd, I'm going to give you the final word on this, and then we can wrap it up.
Sure.
But anything to say to anyone listening out there?
Well, I've said it before, but I can't say it enough, and I will say it again. I can't thank you all enough. There's a lot of fans from a lot of the bands that I've been with over the years since I started recording professionally in 1980, 81. And if it wasn't for you people out there that listen and enjoy and encourage and are enthusiastic about this, I would not be doing it today. I mean, I'm not set, but I'm set enough where I don't have to do music to survive. So I'm still doing this for the fun because of the people like you. And then again, the KISS fans. I never understood how serious the KISS fans were about their music, their liking for KISS, and their admiration for people of the KISS family. You know, not all of them, but most of them seem to have accepted me and other people into the KISS family. And for that, I am forever grateful. And for that, you will be mentioned in the book and on the records, in the credits, and it still to this day. Thank you very much, because you've made it very possible for me to continue doing this. And from the bottom of my heart,
awesome.
I thank you all.
Thank you, Todd.
Really do.
Thank you very much. And you are more than welcome anytime you want to come on here and just chat. Always an open door, my friend.
Thank you, Cameron. I appreciate it. Like I said, you did a tremendous job. You did your homework, and you know, you touched bases here and there. Very clever, very well done, and it was much appreciated. And I thank you for contacting me.
Absolutely. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Todd Howarth right here on Alive Unplugged, the Music of KISS. Thank you once again, sir. Have a good night, and we'll be playing some songs on this podcast for sure for you.
Well, thank you. We'll be talking soon, Cameron.
All right. Take care, sir.
See ya.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/AliveUnplugged. I'm Cameron Duty, reminding you that it ain't a crime to be good to yourself. We'll see you next time.